and doctors set about their study of flash blindness. Out of this experiment will come considerable specific knowledge about protection and treatment for men of the armed forces and the citizens of their country. All of this even as the Charlie Cloud continues to boil. As the cloud begins to drift and roam beyond the test site, high priority is given to the earliest possible recovery of some experiments and data, like the animals of the military biomedical experiments. When the okay from RadSafe is received, we move in rapidly to collect our animals. Time now becomes the most important commodity, for these are living, breathing beings. Although still completely out from the effects of anesthesia, they can only go so long without food and water. So they are quickly removed from their blast line stations and carefully carried to the waiting trucks. In another area not too far away, our test rats are removed from their electrically heated tubes. November nights in the Nevada desert are not exactly warm. This is but another project in our continuing research on the effects of thermal and nuclear radiation and its ultimate application to the effects and responses on humans subjected to atomic explosions.
Hi, Rat.
Hi, Paul.
How's the area for Shotgun 8 to come in?
The atomic cloud has moved over far enough, leaving the aerial space uncontaminated. The RadSafe monitors have checked the landing strip and found it radiologically safe.
Good.
Shortly after recovery, the dogs, with their protective jackets removed, are snug in metal cages. They're on their way to meet Shotgun 8 for the trip by air back to their home laboratories. A great deal may depend on these animals. The vital facts and figures gained by our living instruments could mean the saving of many lives, perhaps yours and mine. These dogs will play an important role in formulating new healing techniques, for without them, we are handcuffed, unable to observe, study, treat, and heal. In the sky, some distance from the test site now, the atomic cloud is still very much in being, colorful, in its own way, fascinating, carrying with it the radioactive products of the fission explosion. The biography of every atomic cloud is essentially the same. The intense heat and violence of the fireball as it sears the sky causes the spectacular and colorful rust-like condition in the air around it. As the fireball cools, an enormous vacuum and afterwind is created, causing the desert floor to rise up into the cloud itself, to form the characteristic mushroom stem. The cooling also sets up a rapid condensation in the air around the fireball that sometimes produces layers of ice crystals, literally an ice cap. Knowledge gained on previous nuclear weapons tests has produced the theory that once the cloud has formed and stabilized in the sky, the vitally significant fission products and so-called unburned fission fragments don't distribute themselves evenly, but tend to collect in very large, invisible pockets, hot pockets, or cells inside the cloud. The particles that are suspended in these nebulous cells indicate many things that happen inside the bomb, as well as the efficiency of the fission reaction. So attempting to locate the cells and collect samples from them is a mission of the highest priority. Airborne by the winds, the cloud soon shears and spreads thin over an increasingly wide area. The radioactive cells become less concentrated, each one sometimes stretching over many square miles. They can't be seen, but will readily tip their radioactive hand to airborne detectors. Drone B-17s collected samples of the atomic clouds on Crossroads in 1946 and Sandstone in 1948. But on Sandstone, a manned aircraft accidentally encountered a good sample while tracking one of the atomic clouds. For Operation Ranger, All of the cloud samples were collected by manned aircraft. On Greenhouse, the test at Eniwetok in the spring of 1951, samples collected by manned aircraft equaled those gathered by drone planes. So manned samplers now have their permanent place in nuclear weapons testing, very probably replacing the pioneering drones entirely. At this moment, the samplers are orbiting at several altitudes a short distance downwind, awaiting the order for their first penetration of the cloud. Mounted on their wings and fuselage are filter boxes, holding chemically pure papers to capture sample particles of the cells, if they can be located. The men inside are standing by, making final preparations for their first pass through the Charlie Cloud. Their operations are based on considerations of each cloud individually. Their penetrations are ordered from the CP. Charlie Cloud, H plus 1 hour and 30 minutes.
Take a look, Hal. It's okay to me. Okay, let's see. Say, that's Cream Puff 3, isn't it, Paul?
Yes, that's Cream Puff 3. How's it look?
Well, it looks pretty good. Why don't you have him try a first penetration?
That's okay, Hal. Let's try Plan 3, though.
Plan 3, is that okay, Hal?
Right.
Hello, Cream Puff 3. This is Keyhole. You're cleared to start first penetration. Follow Plan 3.
Visually, Cream Puff 3 seeks out and heads for the most dense portion of the cloud. His mission plan is simple. Before reaching the visible cloud, the sensitive survey meters in the plane start to climb as it enters the invisible field of gamma radiation that surrounds the cloud. If the plane misses a cell, the meters return to almost a zero reading when it emerges from the gamma field on the opposite side. If so much as the edge of a cell is touched, the plane is instantly contaminated, and the meters will continue to read comparatively high. The plane will continue to make passes until it has made a sufficient number to collect the required samples. Penetrations are delayed and spaced to keep personnel contamination to a minimum while collecting the vital samples. With a selection of radiation detection instruments inside, the monitor tries to locate and penetrate a cell of hot stuff in the cloud. For anyone who may ever have to work in the hot stuff, the most practical precautions are being tested and proven here on Buster Jangle.
Keyhole from Cream Puff 3. First pass at Fox J, Beacon 600.
Cream Puff 3, this is Keyhole. Proceed with your second pass.
After an atomic cloud sampling mission, the skin of an airplane is highly radioactive. Buster Jangle has provided further opportunity to proof test several solutions to the problem of a short and easy method of cooling off contaminated equipment. RadSafe monitors keep a regular check on the planes. In a few hours, the plane can be sprayed down with a special detergent known officially in RadSafe circles as gunk. The planes were sometimes abandoned for many months to cool off in nature's own good time. The experience gained and the quality of samples collected by these planes in the course of Buster Jangle prove that jet aircraft can get the required samples with less personnel exposure. An aircraft that has become heavily contaminated from working inside an atomic cloud can be cooled off, made radiologically safe, and ready to fly another mission in 24 hours. There is a continuous flow of information into Weather Central at the control point from all over the world, by wire, by teletype, by facsimile. In any test operation involving a radioactive cloud, the final decision to produce that cloud, to detonate a nuclear weapon, is always based on weather. We're looking for the most advantageous time for each detonation. Advantageous for test purposes, as well as the radiological safety of communities in the path of the cloud. Finally, the forecasts are compiled into a single report, a little volume compiled every 6 hours. Through the night before 0 hour, As often as necessary, the test director and his staff will meet with the weather officer for briefing.
The winds at the surface are 330 degrees at 5 knots. At 10,000 feet, they're 330 degrees at 14 knots. And at 25,000 feet, they're 340 degrees at 35 knots. Taking this forecast over to our trajectory problem, we find that the red, blue, and black lines representing the 10, 20, and 30,000 foot levels of the cloud will take a south and southeasterly trajectory and will head right down south into Mexico.
From the IBDA aircraft upstairs, the bombardier gets the word on winds and weather at bombing altitude. An hour and a half later, after three trial runs at altitude to establish the track it will make over the ground for the bomb run, Rosebud nears the end of the base leg of its final pattern.
Get ready to turn in 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, turn.
4 miles below, the experiments and observers at the test site sweat out the final bomb run.
Bombardier, would you open the bomb bay doors, please? Level.
Minus 15 seconds, get ready.
The entire operation now waits on the skill of this man.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Once the flash and dust becomes a thing of the past, and it drifts far away from the Ground Zero crater, preliminary ventures are made into the area by monitors of the RadSafe group. In the language of the radiological safety monitors, the area is hot. Too hot for any immediate full-scale recovery work. Because here, as in all other peacetime work with radioactivity, each man is permitted only a very small total dosage of radiation. Far less than he could safely tolerate in a combat situation. These men know radiation. They live with it daily. Here in the field and at their home laboratories. They have neither fear nor question. They just treat it with respect and observe a few simple precautions. This is a continuing job, this business of atomic testing. The scientist never stops in his search for more efficient use of our stockpile material. We must never stop in our work for more complete knowledge about the effects of atomic weapons. We don't dare. Military effects testing will continue on all atomic tests, equipment, material, and structures. Whether destined for military or civilian use, will be our test devices. A thorough knowledge of blast, nuclear, and thermal radiation is our goal. This is our story of military effects. As we go back to our bases and laboratories all over the country, we leave the test areas as deserted as the ghost mines and towns of the surrounding Southwest that carry their silent memories of boom times and activity. But there's a difference. This remote valley in Nevada is going to come to life and history again, several times a year. There's much to be learned. Our job here has only begun. We realize this even more when we get back to home base with our instruments and data, and have the time to study the results of Buster Jangle and evaluate the next set of military effects programs. And the next. And the next.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton. What you just heard was audio from a recently declassified nuclear weapons test film. Among the lies and distortions contained in the film is the claim that the area that was designated for the tests was, quote, empty desert, unquote. The land belongs to the Western Shoshone tribe, which holds yearly protests there along with non-Indian opponents of nuclear weapons. We're next going to hear from Jay Truman, who grew up on a farm about 100 miles downwind from the test site. He is the executive director of Downwinders, an organization representing civilians living in the area who were exposed to deadly radiation by those tests, which the government promised were safe. The interviewer is Mike McCormick.
I was born December 30th, 1951. About 112 miles in a straight line downwind.
You have an interesting first memory as a child. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the first memory I have of life is sitting on my father's knee out on west of town where we had our cattle and watching the pre-dawn sky light up with an atomic detonation. We were encouraged by the government after the first year of testing to watch history being made, and they would sometimes tell us when the tests were going to be so we could go watch them.
As a child, that first memory, do you remember anything else?
Yeah,
that?
I remember that memory very vividly because it scared the hell out of me. It upset me a great deal. And I don't think I've ever really gotten over it or came to terms with it.
So as a child growing up there, how many tests do you think you saw or experienced?
Well, the best that we can tell from the journal I kept as a child and from my mother's is in excess of 30, 35, somewhere in that range, over the years from 53 to 62.
I don't think many Americans or people anywhere on this planet, for that matter, actually comprehend exactly how many nuclear detonations the U.S. participated in. Could you give us an idea?
We tested in Nevada over 100 above-ground shots. We blew them up above ground. And over 900 underground tests. And we did several hundred more out in the Pacific. We did a roughly somewhere between 1,500 and 1,600 tests altogether. And that is more than all other nations combined.
That's a phenomenal number.
Mm-hmm. So there was one day in 1958, in October 58, where they did five of them in a day in Nevada. They were rushing to get as many in as they could before the 30th of October when they were going to enter a moratorium with the Russians. And they got so much in a hurry, they didn't watch where the wind was blowing, and one of them drifted over Los Angeles.
Talk about some more of the shots and how that affected your life growing up there.
We did both ranching and farming. And on the farm, we raised alfalfa, which went to Mesquite, Nevada, where the dairies were that fed Las Vegas, so they got the hot hay from southwest Utah. And we also raised potatoes, which we shipped to California and to Las Vegas. My dad drove most of them himself in his truck. And we would be on the road, and I went with him a lot before I went to elementary. We'd be on the road in the morning, and you know they would come to a roadblock, and we'd have to get out of the vehicle and go look to the east and you know while they blew one off. And they'd let the traffic proceed. And then coming back, we'd get into the Utah side of the border, west just west of St. George, and they would again stop all the automobiles and run a Geiger counter over them. And they'd say, well, you got to go stop at the service station, have your car hosed off. But there's nothing to worry about.
So a simple hosing of
the fallout off your car, to hell with yourself, as long as you got your car clean, so it didn't click.
What was it like in school at that time?
Well, in school it was very interesting because the first day I went to kindergarten, have been in October of 57. They had some general there. Don't know whether he was Air Force, Army, Marines, or whatever. He just had all the ribbons and all that stuff. He was there with a team of them, and they were passed out to every single class in elementary and high school as well, a little booklet called Atomic Tests in Nevada. And if you go to our website, you'll see the little cowboy with the atomic bomb going off in the distance. That is one of the illustrations out of this little booklet. And it basically, you know, told us that we were active participants in the nation's atomic test program and there was no danger and all this stuff. We had them in our schools every 6 weeks with propaganda films, with reassurances that it was safe. One of my favorite ones was in the fall of 57, late 57, when the Russians, they sent Sputnik up, and then a while later they sent up one that had a dog in it, a spacecraft into orbit. And we had one of these military types into school telling us that that was a perfect example of why we had to defend ourselves against the Russians. Because look what they had done to be cruel enough to send this dog up there. And how it was going to die in space. And how all of us ought to hope that it crashed land and we could help rescue that dog. And this is to a community of ranchers and farmers' kids, all of whom have pet dogs. You want to talk about propaganda and BS, I mean, the government's been real good at it when it comes to the atomic stuff since day one. We had Walt Disney films on, you know, the benefit of the atom and power and films like A is for Atom, B is for Bomb. So they would actually bring in and show the whole town at road shows. 20 years after the fact, we petitioned the, was then still the Atomic Energy Commission, asked that they please remake that film, A is for Atom, B is for Bomb, and add a little more to it called C is for Cancer and D is for Death. And they, of course, didn't respond to it.
That's interesting that you... You bring up the connection they were pointing out to the dog in space, because in the audio we played last week, they clearly stated that one of their most delicate instruments was the animals that they would take out to the test sites and put in cages and or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And detonate the bomb. And then they made it sound that they were very concerned in the piece to take great care in retrieving the animals, but they failed to mention basically they're shipping them back to have them, you know, dissected there.
Oh, it was worse than that. They had one film, I think it was called Target, Nevada, they come and showed us. And it really upset a lot of the people because they had a bunch of pigs that were chained down to little cement pads around the detonation point. And they had little army uniforms on them. And they actually showed them squealing and yelling and burning in this film. And this is in about, this would have been 55, I guess. And it really upset a lot of people. Because they had also built little houses and put mannequins in them and called it Doom Town and all this other crap. And of course, there were over a quarter of a million American troops that were actually involved in tests. I mean, they put them in, had them go in and dig their trenches and then drop an A-bomb on them 1,200 yards away. And after the dust settled, get out of your trench and march into ground zero.
One of the things they brought up in the film was the how important weather was, and that they wouldn't do shots until the weather was just perfect. And it was interesting that the one destination they mentioned was the winds were primarily blowing towards Mexico, so let's do the shot.
They did very few where the tests were going toward Mexico. The preferred trajectory was a northeasterly, north or northeasterly trajectory. So they went up over central Nevada or across Utah or across northern Arizona. Probably less than a dozen sent fallout into Mexico.
So tell me, where did the fallout actually end up falling?
Well, you would think by all of the government hearings and all of the compensation bills that have been passed, the fallout hit southwest Utah, a little bit of eastern Nevada, and part of northern Arizona, and that was the end of it. In 1997, the National Cancer Institute released a report on just one isotope, iodine-131, from Nevada testing, and they said that nationwide, it had caused up to a quarter of a million cases of thyroid cancer. And the from iodine 131, I grew up, I said, about 100 miles downwind. I now live 600 miles north of that in southeast Idaho. Well, the counties with the highest iodine levels are not those where I grew up, but they're the five counties north of me, some 650 miles away. And the highest county for iodine 131 is in Montana. There is not one county in the United States that did not receive some fallout. And if you want to get into the way they are ranked, Richard Miller, who published a book called Under the Clouds, and he has also done some new work, and he's listed the counties, and basically it'll be somewhat of a surprise. For all the isotopes and all the fallout, all the different types of fallout, the highest county, the highest two counties were ports of Washington County and Utah. The county was divided in half, one and two. I was in the section one. Well, the first was divided in three ports. The first three rankings were in Washington County, Utah, Clark County, Nevada, Lincoln County, Nevada, Nye County, Nevada, Kane County, Utah, Mojave County, Arizona, Garfield County, Utah, into Nevada. Then we go clear over, and number 14 is Colorado, Arizona, California, and so on until you get clear down to into the 20s before you get back into Utah, Nevada.
So it just really went all over.
It went all over. A good example was in 1953, where one test, Nancy, was felt to be responsible. Nancy and Simon, two tests, were felt to be responsible for the deaths of about 8,000 sheep that were on the range. And the Simon shot hit heavy in the counties of Utah and Nevada. But it also then, 2 days later, was caught in a violent thunderstorm over upstate New York and rained out over Troy and Albany, New York. And the whole metropolitan Troy and Albany area of Rochester, New York, got as much fallout as we did 100 miles away. Enough to cause considerable problems. And there's the same for many other areas of the country, the Midwest. I like to call it the deadly arc. It stretches from Nevada up through Utah into Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, and on down, and another one comes straight across into Colorado and into Missouri and Iowa. And all those areas at one time or another received as much fallout as we did immediately in the path of the clouds. And the government knew it, the government tracked it, and the government lied about there being any danger.
A lot of the government accounts now are that they state that they didn't have the data.
Except when they got into court. One of the most interesting things, I mean, I mentioned just a few minutes ago that there were a quarter of a million troops that were participated in these damn tests, either in Nevada or in the Pacific, and they're referred to as the atomic veterans. And about the same time in the 1980s, the downwinders in Utah, we took the government to court, and the atomic veterans took the government to court, asking damages for the cancers. But it was interesting because we took different attacks. The atomic veterans took the line that the government didn't know in the beginning that there was any danger, and that the government was liable because when the government did find out, the government didn't warn them that they had been had been exposed and should be on the lookout. We took the line that the government knew all along that people were going to get hurt and didn't do anything about it in the first place. These two cases were going. One was in the federal court in Utah, and the other was in the federal court in California. The government was defended by the same attorney, Joe Chavez, in both those cases. And one of them, of course, said the government didn't know, didn't have the data, didn't have any idea, and the other one said they did. And I have copies of the briefs the government filed in both those court cases. They walked into the atomic vet case in California, where they were, where the atomic vets had said, "You didn't know, but when you found out, you didn't tell us." And the government said, "Well, you got to dismiss this case, Your Honor, because we did too know. We knew all along from day one these guys were going to be harmed, and it was a discretionary function made by the president to that they were expendable and it had to be done for national security, period." A week later, they filed a brief in the case in Salt Lake that said, "Hey, wait a minute. We didn't either know. We never had any idea when this started that anybody was going to get hurt."
It's incredible.
It is. I have the two of them sitting on a shelf where I can look at them every day, where I can see them, the decision from the case in California with the atomic vets and the one on us, as a reminder that never believe a damn thing they tell you when it comes to nuclear weapons and national security, because it's not the security of the nation that's at stake. It's their security against the nation whose lives that whose laws they're breaking, and a nation whose citizens they are endangering the health thereof.
When we talked to you a year ago, we were primarily talking about at that time that the it was looking that the government was potentially going to give compensation to injured nuclear workers. And you didn't seem too optimistic, to say
the
least.
Well, I still don't see it happening yet. I think a good example is what happened with the RICA compensation, the stuff for the uranium miners. Last year, the government also passed a bill which amended the original Compensation Act for the downwinders and the miners, which gave the miners some more benefits and added a few more cancers and all this. And they passed, especially the Native Americans, and they passed it, and everything was supposed to be fine. Except they forgot to put any money into it. So since last June, all downwind fallout victims, all uranium miners, especially hundreds of new claims from Navajo uranium miners who are now able to apply, instead of getting, you know, all they're getting from the government now is a IOU. Here's your IOU. When the White House gets around to asking for the money, you'll get paid.
But it seems that the bulk of the people there, as with all the other downwinders, are, you know, dying quite quickly.
Well, that's the whole point. We had one person, one woman, who died of breast cancer, who had qualified. She actually died holding her IOU, and she was buried holding her IOU. There are some 300 people now holding these IOUs, and there have been a couple of dozen of them die holding them. Their families have lost, in some cases, their homes, their savings, everything, paying the medical expenses of flying off to Valhalla that they have nothing to pay them with. Because even though that they have been awarded these claims, they're not worth the paper that they were awarded on. So when the government says it's going to give all these workers, you know, all this money and all this medical care, well, I'll believe it when I see it.
Go back to living 100 miles from the Nevada test site. The people in your community, the people you went to school with, what's become of them?
The little town where I grew up, it had about 800 people when the testing started. It's an all-Mormon community. Basically there were 800 Mormons and 13 non-Mormons in the whole community. There was no industry. At that time, there was no pesticides used. There had, with those close communities, especially in the Mormon communities, you know everybody. You know everybody's problems. When somebody dies, it's a death in the whole community. And there had been one cancer death in the 1930s and two cancer deaths in the 1940s. From 1955 until 1980, there had been 44 cases of cancer on that valley and 12 other deaths, which I think is a pretty good example of what happened.
And at what point in time did you start making the transition towards being a activist for downwinder issues?
When I was in the first couple of years of junior high school, I started writing letters at that point. I started corresponding with Linus Pauling, for instance. I started writing letters to President Johnson, this kind of thing. By then, we'd already had leukemia start to hit, childhood leukemias, and not just in our community, but we had a couple, and then the community to the east of us had four. It was about the same size. Another one 70 miles away had a cluster of four, and it was adults getting it, and you could sit and hear the government tell you that such rumors were communist propaganda, and then you could turn on Steve Allen's show and watch him interview Linus Pauling 5 minutes later, saying that for every megaton they tested, they killed 8,000 babies. They sentenced 8,000 babies to death with leukemia. So it was, you know, very early it became aware that something was amiss. And the thing that got me more to be an activist was in seventh grade, we had to take a 12-hour civil defense course in school. They had various people come in and teach us certain aspects of it. And we had to take an hour where they taught us how to use a radiation meter. And we couldn't do the class when it was supposed to be because we were getting too much shine off the roof from an underground test that had leaked that morning. And the sensitive meters wouldn't handle it. And asking them, they were telling us that, you know, if the Russians hit Los Angeles, which was 480 miles away, we would probably, because we were in the prevailing wind area, we'd probably have to go stay in a spud cellar, potato cellar, for up to 2 weeks till the fallout decayed. And I asked the jerk, now, why would we have to go in a potato cellar for 2 weeks if the Russians bombed Los Angeles, 480 miles away, when they can blow bombs up 100 miles away from us all the time? We don't have to do anything. And he came back and said, well, you should know better than that. I mean, they're Russian bombs. And at that point, I knew it was time to put on the hip waders, because it was deep. I remember once when I was little, real little, they told us in school that we had to, if we didn't support those bomb tests, the Russians would be here in the morning. Those evil Russians would be here in the morning. Well, 1989, I'm over there in Russia. Over there in northern Kazakhstan, and I'm talking to somebody my age who was on a state farm that grew watermelons and sunflowers that was just about the same distance from their test site that I was from ours. And we were talking back and forth, and he asked me what they told me in school about the test and about the Russians. I says, well, they told us that if we didn't put up with the test, you Russian SOBs would be here in the morning. He looked at me and busted out laughing. He says, well, they told us that we didn't let them test, you capitalist sons of bitches would be here by sundown. It was really interesting sitting there, and they were told the same thing, there is no danger, and we wouldn't hurt anybody, and everybody was dropping dead, and, you know, whoever they went to school with was gone now. And you finally realize that the first thing that happens when a nation decides to take that nuclear pathway, the first thing they have to do is not learn how to fission uranium, but learn how to lie to their own citizens.
It's interesting, too, that at that period of time back in the mid-50s, that the U.S. had on the planning books a series of nuclear first strike attacks on the Soviet Union.
Oh, yes. I think that's been one of the things that have been the most disheartening. But, well, I think the most disheartening thing is finally coming to the realization that the first two bombs that were dropped on Japan were not dropped on the Japanese to end the war, but dropped to scare the hell out of Joe Stalin. Hello, Joe. And realizing that we actually did struggle real hard to be in a position to have enough weapons to launch an attack on the Russians without warning. And it's been very interesting to see that story come out again this week when, it seems like about every 20 years now it's been coming out. 20 years ago, they published a study called Project Dropshot, which was a classified study done on how what the United States needed to be able to take the Russians out in 1954. We just couldn't get enough warheads fast enough.
And it was a pretty extensive plan they had. I understand, mm-hmm. like about 400
exactly.
warheads on
70 cities within so many hours or so many days.
And yet, if you look at the corporate media and how it's portrayed the U.S. nuclear policy, it's always been that, no, we'd never do anything first. It would always be in retaliation.
Yeah. And yet, our whole defense posture in the early days were for first strike. And we, with what the kind of weapons we developed during the Reagan era, for instance, when he modernized everything, they were first strike weapons. They were not weapons to go on being mad. They were weapons designed to fight a nuclear war. Not prevent, but fight. Mutual assured destruction may have been mad, but that concept is pure insanity.
Well, and it looks like we are again, knee-deep in it with the current administration.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I find it interesting that the current defense authorization bill requires them to go ahead and finish development of a new weapon system. It's called an earth-penetrating weapon. It's a weapon designed to penetrate deep into the ground and explode and decapitate the enemy's leadership by blowing up their underground bunkers.
And meanwhile, they're looking at dismantling the ABM treaty.
And not only dismantling the ABM treaty, but you've had Gaffney and a couple of Pearl and a couple of the others say that in order to have a missile defense system, and especially in order to be able to cut down the number of warheads that, like Preston Bush wants to do, we're going to have to resume some kind of limited testing. We're not talking subcritical tests there either. We're talking about the full-blown. Testing of a warhead.
One of the things I found interesting with especially examining the U.S. nuclear first strike options was that at that time a lot of our bombers were based in countries like Pakistan and India.
Pakistan, yeah.
The exact countries that we're getting upset with now for detonating nuclear weapons.
Yes, and I think it's really interesting to see why those countries, especially India, went ahead and developed the nuclear option. It was simply because we refuse to stop all testing, we refuse to stop all development, this kind of thing.
Weren't they part of previous atomic energy programs?
Yes. When the world became very concerned about fallout following the Bravo shot in the Marshall Islands that dusted a couple of the islands and caused burns to natives and killed a Japanese fisherman on a fishing boat in 1954. Everybody got very upset about fallout, and the United States, as a public relations ploy, went out and came up with this Atoms for Peace program. And one of the first things of the program was to give these peaceful reactor technology to other nations to show so that these people could learn how to produce electricity so cheap that even their poor economies could cope with it. And one of the first nations to get one of these Atoms for Peace reactors from the United States was India. And India's scientists learned how to run a reactor, learned how to deal with fissioning uranium, learned how to breed plutonium, et cetera, off one of our Atoms for Peace reactor. And guess what? So did Pakistan. In the interest of preventing the world from forcing us to stop testing and stop developing, we got most of the nations that are now rushing to develop weapons of their own or already have, we got them hooked on it in the name of Adams for Peace.
Now, that was with nuclear energy. Was there also something involving actual nuclear bombs?
Yes, the plowshares. So-called peaceful nuclear explosions. The Bible, it talks about taking your spears and beating them into plowshares, so hence that's where they came up with the name plowshares program. And what it was to basically to use the nuclear weapon as a nuclear dynamite, to use it for peaceful purposes such as changing the course of rivers, building dams, blowing out harbors, using it to fracture the ground so you get better production out of oil and natural gas wells, all this kind of stuff. We blew up several bombs in Nevada testing the cratering technology as part of what we call the Panatomic Canal Study, a study on how we could use 11 megatons worth of nuclear weapons to blast a sea-level canal across the Isthmus of Panama. One of the shots left a crater in the Nevada desert 1,280 feet in diameter and 320 feet deep. I never could solve the fallout problem, so we ended it. We also encouraged the Russians to do the program. And not only encouraged them, but we gave them the plans for the Diamond device. It was a type of nuclear weapon, nuclear explosive device, that you could lower down a oil well casing, an 8-inch oil well casing. And they used that very extensively. Almost all of their underground storage facilities for their natural gas pipelines in Russia were made by blowing up nukes in salt domes and other formations. They also used nuclear devices to fracture the rock in a number of oil fields. One oil field, they did over 40 of these explosions. We played with them in New Mexico and Colorado, and we had even talked about using nukes to help get oil shale by fracturing it up and then setting fire to it underground and all this kind of stuff, a whole lot of crazy ideas. The Russians did over 140 of them. We did 30-some-odd.
It's a little bit of a jump, but talk if you would. Internationally right now, there's at least a week back, there was a flurry of articles relating to an operation or a couple operations called Sunshine.
Oh, Sunshine and Gabriel.
Could you talk about that?
Yes. Back during the 1950s, when they started the bomb test, they were worried about the amount of radiation that they were putting up, and they didn't know what kind of problems it was causing. So they thought, well, we better measure how much radiation is going out into people around the world, but we have to do it in secret. So they set up a Project Gabriel first, and then later it was merged into Project Sunshine. And what they were doing was to measure the amount of strontium-90 that was going into the bones. So what they did is they decided to steal, illegally obtain without permission, the bodies of stillborn babies and babies born up, up to 5 years of age. Around the world, we're not talking one or two, we're talking somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 bodies of babies were stolen from various locations around the world, sampled, cremated, and the ashes then smuggled in the United States for testing by the Atomic Energy Commission. Later on, they went into using adults. Under Project Sunshine, instead of talking about the amount of radiation in the bones, they decided they would call them sunshine units, because sunshine units sounded a lot less benign and a lot less dangerous than, pack of curies or curies or millicuries of strontium-90. They also, stole specimens. Tissue specimens and autopsy specimens from adults, around the United States. We We complained when they were doing the stuff on human experimentation about several break-ins to mortuaries in rural Utah, where you know everybody had assumed at the time that somebody had sliced away on a few loved ones here and there. And now it's been hit the news again because people found out that Britain cooperated with the United States in doing it, and we're getting babies out of Hong Kong and even doing it with their allies in Australia and New Zealand.
And yet none of this is being picked up by U.S. media.
Very little. It's big news in Australia. It's huge news in Hong Kong, where they're demanding investigations, and in Australia, where they're not only demanding investigations of that, but they're demanding investigations on rumors that Britain had denied 20 years ago, and now they found people who swear to God they witnessed it, where they had flown in some severely retarded and disabled patients from England to use them as guinea pigs in atomic bomb tests. Britain did its first atomic bomb test over Aboriginal land in Australia and off the coast. And those rumors are now being formally investigated by the Aussies, and they're also investigating, you know, the use of troops from Australia and New Zealand, who were done like our atomic vets were, and who apparently were exposed to radiation as a test to see how the uniforms held up. And that isn't getting too much media attention here either.
So just to clarify, that latest flap in Australia was because they'd flown handicapped people.
That's the latest one that came out, but it all started on this body snatching stuff for the for the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. That's where the investigations first started, and now they're finding out all kinds of things, both to do with what the U.S. did and what the British did.
And I remember reading in several publications, including American Ground Zero, which you are one of the people featured in there as well, that atomic veterans, there were several accounts of actually seeing at the Nevada test site.
Exactly, yes.
Actual people chained.
Exactly. Not only them, but some of the workers. I've heard those things from workers for 30 years, from local law enforcement people. And everybody pretty much knows it happens, but you're up against the wall of they've got the data and all you've got is the memories.
It's really horrifying, to say the least.
Well, we hauled simulated fallout up to Alaska and dumped it over Inuit villages to measure where it would get into their food chain, into their bodies, as a preliminary study for using nukes to blow a harbor for tankers to haul oil off of Alaska's North Slope.
As well as I had just heard recently, the Yakimas, which are along the Hanford Nuclear Reservation,
yes,
have found evidence that they were actually tested upon with radionuclides to see the effect for what would be the equivalent of depleted uranium type situations today.
Well, see, it was really interesting because we were the school kids I went to school with, we were studied in the 1960s. They came into our school in the 1960s and studied us for thyroid study. And when they came into my school, they came in there and said, there are these wonderful scientists, you know, here from the Mayo Clinic. They're here to study you because you don't have adequate medical care. They didn't bother to tell us they were there from the U.S. Public, as a joint venture from the Utah United States Public Health Service and the Atomic Energy Commission to study how many of us they may have killed on the bomb test. And they studied our thyroids. They even took blood tests of all students, all without, you know, signed consent from our parents. About 3,000 of them.
What was the parents' reaction when they found out about that?
Well, they were not very happy about it. It took years before we actually realized what was going on. At first they, you know, told us, yeah, well, we're studying the thyroids, but, you know, we didn't find anything. And when they came back 20 years later and wanted to restudy us again, I said, well, maybe a case or two. And now they're asking to study us a third time, and several hundred of us are pledging to each other that we're not going to, they're not going to get their hands on our necks again. The parents were not very happy about it. They knew they were being lied to by then. But what do you do?
So as the director of the Downwinders, what things are you focusing on now? What campaigns?
Well, number one, we want to get something done about, you know, I mean, about the compensation problems, and especially in extending the coverage to all those who were exposed. Not just those that were exposed in a few counties in Utah that might vote for a certain senator every 6 years, but those in whatever states of the nation that received equivalent doses. And we're also deeply concerned about talk about a possible resumption of testing, which we will not tolerate.
How about the current push in the administration for renewing our nuclear energy policy?
Well, I guess that means I get a resurgence. And I saw one article today about how there was going to be a resurgence in nuclear power business. I guess if they're going to have that kind of a resurgence, that probably means there's going to also be a resurgence in Navajo uranium miners dying of lung cancer and being told that it's nothing to do with the radon. Resurgence in the number of tailings piles splattered across the Colorado Plateau. I think that pretty much ought to say where, you know, what our feelings are about that push for nuclear power to solve our problem. Doesn't matter whether it's military or whether it's peaceful. There is not, you know, it's still the atom, and it's still radioactive, and it still has problems with waste that have never been solved. And the main problem that's never been solved is the government's inability to tell the truth about those health effects. And more nuclear power doesn't mean more solutions to our energy problems. It means more cancer and death.
I had forgotten to ask you a question about the fires that happened last summer.
Yeah.
And seemed to strike so many.
They seemed to strike so many nuclear facilities, especially in the West, and especially areas of those facilities where the government seems to have had to be doing an awful lot of samples of vegetation and this kind of stuff to keep track of all the crap they've dumped on it, the radioactive materials they've dumped on it for years. Now they just went up in smoke, so why they have to worry about it?
So it was a pretty convenient way of taking
that's
care
what a lot of us think. Yeah, we'll see. This is going to be an even worse fire year this year. We'll see how many contaminated areas withstand the threat this year.
Do you think those fires were a great danger to those people that were, you know, within range of the smoke?
No, I think it would depend on the close proximity they were to some of them, and what some of the sites may have been. Unfortunately, like when the fire up in Idaho, they turned off some of the monitors before they left, before they evacuated the area, so we don't really know what the readings were.
And I believe it happened at, do you know the exact number of facilities it happened for during the course of a year? It was like,
oh, it happened at Rocky Flats. It happened at Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory. It happened at Hanford. It happened at Los Alamos. It happened at the Nevada Test Site. It happened at Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Oh, there's a couple of Air Force stuff here and there that I can't remember the exact name of, but it gives you, you know, somewhat of a general idea.
So pretty phenomenal year for...
Oh, yeah.
And how do people contact you and your organization?
We're on the Internet. We have a website which has a lot of information on it, which is www.downwinders.org. And it has the contact numbers and all that kind of stuff.
All right, what else? Anything else that you can think of offhand that's really been rubbing you the wrong way of late?
I think the thing that's, one of the things that bugged me the most is kind of the sense of deja vu listening to Bush, and the same old, same old. same old excuses of, well, we have to have this for security, so because we need this, we should junk the ABM treaty, we should do this, we should do that. It doesn't matter what other nations think. It doesn't matter what the Russians think. We're right. Everybody else is wrong. I have heard that a few too many times over the years. And it's that kind of attitude that breeds arms races. If the Cold War is over and all this stuff, then why do we need to keep playing the same old games?
That was Jay Truman, director of the Downwinders Organization.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.